So we're here today at Splash, Sacramento Splash here in Mathers, California, and we're talking about heritage knowledge in this unit. And it was really fun to be in the room while Eva Butler was talking about Splash and talking about the efforts that went into conserving some land and to create a beautiful nature center, which is where we're with this audience today. And really lovely just to have children here and to go back into my childhood, essentially, you know, walking into the room down the hall that has glass terrariums that actually have snakes in them, and they're native snakes. And it's so fun for me because, you know, when I was, starting really when I was 6, 7 years old, my grandmother used to encourage me to go catch the native animals that lived around that we would find in the field guides. And then she had rules, and that was Cecilia McCormick, and she was from Irish lineage. Her family came over during the potato famine, and they were farmers in this place called Irishtown, which is now Colts Neck in Homedale, New Jersey, where I grew up. But she had some magic from her lineage, clearly, because she knew that children love errands, and she would send me out to catch stuff and then bring it back to her, or go out and catch fish in the local farm pond and bring them back and she would cook them, or go out and gather berries, bring them back and she'd make a pie. You know, she knew the power of errands, and all indigenous traditional cultures know the power of errands. So one of the errands that I went on, which actually contributed to my heritage knowledge in the long run, you know, I went out and caught native species when they were really common where I grew up. And you could always catch a corn snake, you could always catch a milk snake, a hognose snake, you could catch, a black rat snake. There was all kinds of snakes when I was a boy, and there was many species of turtles. And the egg-laying snakes and the egg-laying turtles were pretty common in Monmouth County, New Jersey when I was a boy. But when I was entering into my early 20s, virtually all the egg layers were extirpated, which was, I felt the shock of that. It's the relationship that we develop with heritage species, you know, things that tell us an ecosystem is healthy, things that need a certain kind of attention and care to guarantee that they'll be there for the next generation, right? It requires heritage knowledge. And where does heritage knowledge come from? I mean, you know, you could get it from a book. But the truth of the matter is, all the research shows that if you go to university and you read about heritage knowledge, it doesn't root. You know, it doesn't change your values necessarily. But if you grow up in relationship with what are called heritage species and you have direct personal relationship with heritage species, then you care about them, and then you care about what supports heritage species, which is always the ecosystem. And the heritage species themselves, by default, you know, because you interact with them, you learn about what they need. And so you begin to learn ecology just from interacting. So heritage knowledge is a hallmark of healthy cultural relationships between people and place. And it's also an indicator that there was really high quality connective experiences with enough heritage species within a bioregion to generate heritage knowledge in the adults and in the elders, right? You know, the conservation movement is essentially built on this phenomenon. You know, so for those of you who are sitting on the edge of your seat wondering what happened to all those poor things that I caught in the wild and put in terrariums, and, you know, did they die of starvation? Did I overhandle them? You know, what were, you know, did I break all the rules? But, you know, I was a trained wildlife handler from a young age. I worked at the Monmouth County Park System. I took care of all the snakes and all of the lizards and turtles. I cleaned their cages, and I had some great mentors. But my grandmother was my first. And what she did for me was she had a rule. And she said, and you might, this was before television had any attractive value. So, you know, if you think about a terrarium, it's somewhat like a television if there is no television. Yeah, it's a glass thing. It's rectangular. There's stuff moving around. There's light, you know. And for me, I could sit for hours just watching. Literally, I remember I probably spent an hour counting how many times a rattlesnake inhaled and exhaled inside the terrarium, one of the native rattlesnakes, because I was like so curious. It seemed dead. I swore it was dead, you know, because it was so still. And that was when I was working at Monmouth County Parks years later. But I could literally just stare at that rattlesnake. And then after like 20 minutes, I saw its side heave ever imperceptibly, almost, you couldn't detect it almost, right? And then you saw it contract again, like every 20 minutes. It had like 3 breaths an hour. It was so still. I thought, wow, that critter knows about stillness. You know, like I was really impressed. But, you know, what did my grandmother say? She said, okay, here's the rules. The moment first you have to name it. You have to tell me where you caught it. And obviously you have to take really good care not to hurt it. And if in trying to catch it, you could hurt it, then you let it go. You know, so she had these ethics that I really adhered to. She always asked me about the story of the catch when I got back. She wanted to know all the details. Where did I catch it? Were there others? Tell me about the place. You know, do you remember that place? Because when you get bored of that animal that, and you no longer watch it, then it's time for you to put it right back where you found it. And if it needs to hibernate, then it can't overwinter with you. You have to let it go. Plenty of time for it to get what it needs to survive. So things tend to rotate, you know, through my terrariums at that age. You know, maybe I'd have them for a week or two, maybe a month, and then I'd put them back, you know, and that was really cool. And then, of course, you know what that leads to, right? It's a passion, and it starts to grow. So by the time I was a teenager, my grandmother had passed on all of that care, giving instruction. I was now a volunteer taking care of the animals at the local nature center, and I basically had this daylight basement in my parents' house that, you know, there was a window where the sunlight shone in from the south, and I just completely filled that thing. People were putting terrariums, or they're called aquariums, actually. And these are the TVs that people got bored with, or maybe they didn't want to take care of them after a while. So at large item pickup day, which is a special trash day, there'd be all these treasures for me. And they would be aquariums that people were putting out for the trash guy to take away. And I'd just get them and bring them home, and then I'd start thinking, what do I want to catch now? You know. And by the time I met Tom Brown Jr. when I was 10, I probably had 15 terrariums going with native species, right? And I also would go to the pet shop and get stuff now and again, too. And then I finally figured out that I really wanted a big snapping turtle, so I got a kiddie pool from Kmart, you know, and put that in my basement and filled it with water and made an island so, you know, the painted turtles that were swimming around with it could get up on top. And then people were bringing me injured animals. And, you know, you see these relationships, right, that form between a human being and the native species. What do you think is happening to my understanding of ecology without even trying? You know, I'm not reading ecology books. I'm not studying ecology. But when I get to high school and study ecology in the biology class for the first time, the professor's really impressed with my ecology knowledge. But where did it come from? You know, it came from my connection to the heritage species of my area. So you could think about heritage knowledge as something that needs to be modeled by that stage of life. It needs to be voiced through story. You know, and it was my grandmother's story that got me inspired to have my own stories, right? You see that intergenerational thing happening right there. I remember when Gilbert Walking Bull was alive, and he was working with various Eight Shields locations around the country. Mark Morey, who's one of the Eight Shields early collaborators who really helped do a lot of the R&D for this project that I'm working on right now, Mark asked Gilbert in front of the young children at Wilderness Awareness School, hey, do you have any stories when you were a boy of catching wild animals? You know, and it was such a great question, you know, because Gilbert's like, oh, you know, and he just launched into all these stories. And he had a skunk for a pet, you know, and they never descented it. And he had all these funny stories that made everybody laugh, you know, but everybody loved the skunk, and they all learned how to deal with it in such a way as to not, you know, upset it, you know. He had a pet eagle at one point, you know, he had a pet owl, you know, these were all injured things that ended up in his care, you know, and he had so many stories, and it was so fun to listen. Children have a natural instinct to want to bond with certain species, and it's not all species, by the way, all species are not created equal. In the Southeast, well, I mean, in some sense they are, of course, but in their attractiveness, natural attractiveness to children, there are certain species that really children are motivated to interact with. And we talk about that in the vitality section under errands. When you understand that children can't resist certain errands, certain species have a even more attractive value, you can send children out on errands, and then the animals and the birds and the berries take over the job of mentoring the children. You know, they begin to build that heritage knowledge into the children. So the foundation of heritage knowledge is based on a childhood of relationships built with heritage species, and then guidance from elders, you know. And I see right now, you know, and this is our third nature center that we've been at doing during the series, but I've been really paying attention to which generations are coming to these events. And I keep thinking about the communities that are lucky enough to have conservation-oriented nature centers where a lot of elder docents are there. And the young people who get to grow up around that, no doubt, by osmosis, are going to experience that powerful role modeling of these deeply connected elders. And the children are going to naturally find that those instincts are turning on and resonating. You know, and so I think of an organization like the Bovary Nature Center, Audubon Canyon Ranch, or here where we are today at Splash in Sacramento. Just the presence of elders in a informal time with young people around, you know, like during the breaks in these recording sessions, watch the interactions and the magic that occurs, you know. So if a child is lucky enough to have regular exposure to that, in modern times, they are likely to grow up with heritage knowledge. And then when they're in their 40s and 50s, they're likely to do what Eva and the Splash Group has done here, you know, and they'll take on a conservation project because heritage knowledge driven by heritage connection, they care about the future generations of life, people, and nature. We all should have the opportunity that we've all had to enjoy this place and these special ecosystems that happen to be preserved by accident, technically, because the Army or the Air Force was not necessarily interested in conservation when they set up their base, but by setting up their base, they created this undisturbed place, and so certain native habitats survived that didn't survive in other places, you know, and that, but it takes someone with heritage knowledge to see that that's an opportunity, okay? So I think, you know, it's a really great place to be starting out talking about heritage knowledge, and I think we can understand that it drives conservation, but back up one step and realize something super critical to understanding connection modeling, and that is that heritage knowledge starts with heritage connection. And heritage connection starts with individual relationships between people and species, and often individuals, like my milk snake or my rat snake, right, or my friend the turtle. You know, you build a bond with these things. That bond builds greater knowledge and connection with the ecosystem, and that leads to deeper passion and understanding of heritage knowledge, which leads to conservation leadership. Those things, you can't go straight to conservation leadership. You know, no formal education will get somebody the passion to be there. It is really about connection first. One more example of this to kind of put this in perspective. I love to talk to school teachers who work with, you know, children between 9 and 12. And the reason I like talking to all school teachers, but I really love when I'm doing teacher trainings and then I say to the teachers when they're all in one room and it's all that age group that they're working with, and I say, you know that girl that's in your class? You know the one that she's got her hand up like this and she watches you when you walk around and you notice that she's not like straining to have her hand up, right? She's got like powerful muscular control over the hand, and you immediately feel nervous because you know that she's looking, she's going to find that moment when she can insert herself, and you're like, oh my God, oh no, don't let me give her an opportunity because here we go, right? And you know how you're talking about math and you think it's a safe subject, so you call on her. And yet again, she proves that she can take anything and bring it back to horses. You know that girl, right? And they're all like, yeah. You know, and they're all body nodding. Yeah, I know that girl. I got her in my class. You know, I got a couple of them. You know, I'm like, yeah, exactly. But are you worried about her future as an educational perspective? Oh, God, no. You know, she's really creative. She's really smart. She's always doing her homework. And I said, why does she always do her homework? Well, because she's not allowed to go see her horse unless she does her homework, because her parents figure that out at some point, right? So she's motivated, and she's also incredibly creative. And then she has, are you worried that she doesn't have enough information? Oh, my God, no. She can talk for days and weave this entire story to get from math back to the horse. You know, so she's obviously linking things, you know, cognitively. I'm like, right. She may have read books about horses, but I guarantee you what's really happening is that she has this profound connection with horses. And profound connection pulls knowledge behind it. You know, think of a locomotive pulling cars, right? A big freight train full of knowledge. The locomotive is connection. And, you know, when you really understand that, you can see how connection can really be useful to work into any setting, you know, whether, you know, but education, there is absolutely no conflict between connection process and education, except where there's too rigid adherence to certain classroom management practices. So, you know, the only thing that gets in the way is adherence to certain classroom management practices, because they can be at odds with connection. But once you figure out how to weave those two together, connection and knowledge are really good friends. You know, connection accelerates knowledge. So in this case, connection with individual species changes the way we see the world. And that's very important to consider. And if you thought about, okay, the Department of Education and their mandate for the students to learn certain things by a certain age, and you take that concept of a mandate to learn certain things by a certain age, you will find that every single culture around the world, even healthy indigenous traditional cultures that seem like they're illiterate or non-cognitive, you know what I mean? Like maybe you might think, well, they're just hunter-gatherer nomads. They don't really have education. That is not true. You will find that traditional indigenous hunter-gatherer nomadic societies like the Bushmen, for instance, have this really powerful Department of Education and a really powerful mandate for certain learned experiences by certain ages. Because the bottom line is, if your children don't have enough of what they need at a certain age, they are definitely going to die in the Kalahari, because the Kalahari is unforgiving. And I want you to know also that when they're adults and when they have built that understanding of their place, that traditional ecological knowledge, you've never met more chill people than on the planet. They are the most relaxed, easygoing, unconcerned people you've ever interacted with. They make you relax in ways that you didn't even know you could relax. Like they're role modeling it. You know, so because it's not bare, what's his name, Grylls? It's not Bear Grylls. You know, it's not like Bushman versus Kalahari. Let me show you how it's done. Right? Their connection to every living being on the Kalahari is so profound that their heritage knowledge goes beyond your ability to even perceive. Even for a guy like me who has really rich heritage knowledge background and I study heritage knowledge in traditional cultures, when I get around them, I am still fascinated by how much they know in a really practical way, and how much they are a reflection of that. So in the same way the girl is a reflection of the horse has changed her, right? Even the muscle control, right? So even physically, she's different because of her connection with one species and one individual within that species. And then there's the boy like me, you know, with all the little snakes and frogs and turtles and lizards and all the ways those things have changed me, because each one of them has influenced me as much as I've influenced them. Now take that and magnify it by 500 species, and now you've got a Bushman. And add to that profound knowledge of the sun, the moon, the stars, and not just knowledge, but connection with. You know, one of the most fascinating things to consider is, you know, the experiments they were doing with Aboriginal Australians when they were bringing them into rooms that had no windows and concrete buildings and spinning them all around, and then they could unerringly point south, north, east, west, with no geographic reference. They just had an internal compass that knew exactly which way every direction was. And my friend Miles is a songline anthropologist. He basically defends native land claims in Australia for the Aboriginal councils based on people's songline knowledge. So if you know enough, if you have enough heritage knowledge in your family, and Miles knows how to cross-examine them in court to bring that knowledge out for the jury to hear, then they will actually win the land claim, right? So Miles has got some insight on these people, right? Miles Holmes. Miles was saying that when our kids are little and they come in the room and they go, C-A-T, cat, everyone goes, yay, right? Or A, B, C, D, E, F, G, you know, and we sing along with them and then we're like, yay. He says the Aboriginal kids, when they're little like that, they're doing the same thing with North, yay, you know, when they're really little, you know? So like the elders and the adults are all modeling that profound connection with North and East and South and West, so that the children have this heritage knowledge that goes beyond species, you see? River, mountain, trees, bushes, insects, you know, there's nothing they're not connected to, because every single one of these connections tells them about the other connections. So they figure out early on that, wow, if I know about the birds, then they'll tell me where the snake is, right? And so they see the interrelationship of all this stuff, and it also becomes important not only to keep them alive because the birds warn of danger, it also, where's the best food? You know, when I'm thirsty and I can't find surface water in the dry season, which root do I dig up, and what does it look like in the dry season? And, you know, both Molly and Mandy Lee, I think you both witnessed this plant called bee, which, you know, they're walking along and they turn and they look and they go over and start digging. And we always kind of stop and say, what are you digging? How did you know to dig there? And they said, oh, this right here. And there's this little withered stick. And I mean, it's like this tall and it's absolutely nondescript. It doesn't look like anything. And it's mixed with all kinds of other withered sticks. But they have this profound connection with this plant, bee. And then they dig this root up and they pull it out and it's round like a turnip. And then they scrape it like, you know, it looks like they use a carrot grater on it, literally, because they use these sticks in this really expert way. And they just sit there and work the root and they get these, which are looks like carrot shreds, but they're white. And then they squeeze them and then the water drips down and goes into their mouth. But the cool thing about this particular plant is that it's more thirst quenching than water because of the biochemistry of it. And so if someone is really dangerously dehydrated, if you give them water, you could actually kill them. And the Bushmen know this. So they'll bury people when they find them. And they often find, you know, scientists dying of thirst in the Kalahari. I'm serious. This story has happened many times with scientists in the Kalahari. They find these guys after they've been lost for 4 or 5 days and they can't find their way back to their research camp, you know, and they're nearly dead. And the Bushmen find them and then they bury them in a kind of shady place. And they only drip the bee juice in their mouth until they recover enough hydration, and then they give them water. There's like this one doctor who said, how did they know that? How did they know? Because they don't even have access to water like that. You know, they've never, like, back in the day when they learned that give them bee first if they're dehydrated, they wouldn't have had, like, the opportunity to slug a canteen of water because there was no such thing. You know what I mean? Like, they live in a really dry place, and water's super precious. So this is all heritage knowledge, you see, but what do they do? What do the Bushmen do to bring about heritage knowledge? Well, they start their children off very early, and they are, you know, out doing things in the day, and as we talk about in Coyote's Guide to Connecting with Nature, when they come back in, they are caught by their grandmothers and grandfathers and aunties and uncles, and they're asked questions about their day, and through the storytelling that they do with the elders, the elders are picking up on what are they paying attention to and what are they missing. You know, so the elders then have the opportunity to pull on their stories and connect them more effectively, right? The last piece I'd like to share in this regard, which I shared in a different context on a different one of these 512 volumes, is a story from Gilbert Walking Bull, which will come up also in this series a little bit later and a little bit differently. Gilbert talked about the fact that humans have an instinct. He would say their spirit knows, okay? Their spirit knows. They're born, their spirit knows that this is what they need. So you might say, that's like an internal hardwired nervous system response. Like the body is basically saying, I need this. Okay, so we have this internal knowing from a young age that we're supposed to bond with different animals and different plants and different trees and different creeks and rocks and things. We know it. And he says that it's the job of these things. Okay, so this is a traditional ancient Lakota kind of perspective on it. It's the job of the animal or the lizard to help the child gain a piece of its essence. And that goes into that person's, he said, it's like the brain is unformed. It has potential, but it's unformed. And it's the job of the animals and the plants and the birds and the insects to come in and form that human being and teach them how to be a human being. And through that learning from all these different species, they gain understanding of how to care for that place. And that's how he explained it. And it's a really a common traditional understanding, you know, of the wisdom keepers. They all have a similar way of describing it. No matter where you are on the planet, you'll hear the elder wisdom keepers talking about the purpose of the other beings other than humans to teach the humans how to be human and then how to be tenders of that place. So that is heritage knowledge in a nutshell and the importance of it and also a little bit of the framing of how we get there. So thank you.